hppodcraft.com.
The red light flashed on the air. Hinkty synthesizer music composed for the tone deaf began going out at 90.7 megahertz. Bert Handelsman, crack engineer, made a circle with thumb and forefinger, and for the 541st time in the 11 years it had been on KPFK-FM in Los Angeles, hour 25 was on the wing. The clock in the booth said 10.02 p.m. Good evening, this is your host for hour 25, Mike Hodel, and my guest tonight is Harlan Ellison. For those of you who've read Mr. Ellison's 40 books, very close to almost 1,000 short stories, articles, television columns, essays, or commentaries, or who've seen his teleplays on commercial television, he needs no introduction. For those of you to whom Harlan's name isn't a household word, Ellison cut in, have yourselves put under house arrest for terminal illiteracy.
Zing! That was a snarky, somewhat insulting intro to the Harlan Ellison story, The Hour That Stretches. It's a story that we're going to be covering here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
We're here at hppodcraft.com and Patreon, continuing our short series of Harlan Ellison stories. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. This is a strange story because the author is the protagonist of his own story. And I don't think that we've ever read a story like that on our show before.
We may have, but this is an even stranger story because it's not really a story. It's really more of a series of story pitches that Harlan Ellison either derides or builds upon. I have to admit, I didn't quite know what to make of this one.
Mm-hmm.
Was this one of the ones that Patton recommended to us?
It is, yeah. This is one that Patton recommended. I don't know if he recommended it because it specifically name drops Lovecraft in it.
I think that must be what it is, because that happened in the last story as well. There was a Lovecraft name drop. So I think these are just tangentially, if you know, close to a Lovecraft story. But this is a really odd one to read. And I'm sure that our synopsis will perhaps make it even more odd. It's worth checking out, but it is hard to explain what's going on here. Hey, speaking of odd, who was that reader?
That reader was Levi Nunez, longtime friend of the show, yes, a talented voice actor and all-around great guy.
I love Levi. I cannot believe this is the first time we've had him on the show.
It's a crime, and Pfeiffer, you're going to jail for it.
Oh, man, I deserve to serve the time, I gotta admit.
Well, one of us has to take the rap, and it ain't gonna be me.
All right, I'll take the rap. But, you know, hopefully I'll have good behavior, and that means Levi will be able to come back on the show. So.
Yay!
That would be the best outcome. We might as well just dive into it. The Hour That Stretches, what's the setup?
Yeah, so the story takes place on a historically real radio show called Hour 25. It was broadcast weekly on KPFK in Southern California from 1972 until 2000.
And I believe it still continues in some form as an internet show, but episodes are very, very sporadic.
Yes. In the past, it had big name writers on there. Harlan Ellison, of course, Terry Pratchett, Larry Niven, Laurie R. King, and of course, Neil Gaiman.
Yeah, if you just look at YouTube and look up Hour 25, you can find interviews with Philip K. Dick, Jack Kirby, Robert Silverberg. Everybody came on the show at some point. And there's an archive of episodes online as well in a couple of different places. So you can listen to the stuff that's come out since 2000, but there's also some of the old 70s and 80s episodes that I was able to dig up. The show was really plugged into the sci-fi community, particularly in the Los Angeles area. I actually like to hear the calendar segment where Terry Hodel tells you about sci-fi happenings in Los Angeles from back in the day, you know, screenings of Bela Lugosi and the Phantom Creeps at the Mar Vista Library, you know, running for 3 days, that sort of thing. It's kind of interesting to have a peek into what the world was like pre-internet.
Harlan Ellison actually hosted the show for a time, as well as Steve Barnes and J. Michael Straczynski. The show was the longest running sci-fi radio show ever, but now it lives, like you said, on the internet. The host currently is Warren James. It slowed down over the years, so I think now there's only two episodes, and each one of those episodes is just like a Christmas reading and a Halloween reading.
Right, just public domain science fiction stories for those holidays, right.
But fun fact, the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society was on Hour 25 in 2003.
Oh, hey, nice. I didn't realize that.
It was for their Scary Solstice album, and they performed a bunch of their songs.
Well, I have to admit, I never really listened to the show. I wasn't aware of it.
Me neither.
Even though I listened to that radio station sometimes.
This story is set in the era of Mike Hodel being the host, and specifically the year 1982. And the setup is that Harlan is a last-minute replacement for another guest, Dr. Jerry Purnell, a sci-fi writer and one of the first internet bloggers.
Ooh.
Harlan comes off very rude and grumpy in this story.
Yeah, he sure does.
And we get that with him saying that Dr. Purnell is off in the Sierra Maestra Mountains of Cuba helping to train marauders for the violent overthrow of Fidel Castro, or backpacking, or some dumb thing like that. So Hodel chastises him, saying Harlan knows that none of that is true, and Harlan says, of course I know it. That doesn't mean I won't malign the man, even if he is my friend. In fact, I'll malign him because he's my friend. I mean, anybody who calls Harlan Ellison a friend is obviously a thoroughly corrupt, degenerate sod.
That's funny because when we recorded On the Slab, our first Harlan Ellison story this month, I made fun of him for being petty toward an old teacher, which I left in the show, but I did cut the section. I made like a snoring sound, but right after that, I actually called him a f***ing narcissist. And I thought, you know what, we're kicking off this series. Maybe I don't want to be that harsh. So yeah. I left the snore, but cut the narcissist bit. Mm-hmm. But, you know, after reading this, I was, and especially him saying that anybody who's his friend is a corrupt, degenerate sod, I thought, well, crap, maybe I should have left that in. I mean, if he's all about insulting his friends and having them insult him, I was being too light of a touch, perhaps.
Yeah, well, you're just a sensitive soul, Pfeiffer.
I am. That's true.
Dr. Purnell is at a sci-fi convention in Pasadena called Lungfish Con, most likely in the middle of a talk, to which Harlan says, the topic of which is labia and broadsword imagery in contemporary sci-fi.
That one was pretty funny, actually.
Which I thought was pretty funny.
Yeah, since a lot of sci-fi is male fantasy wish fulfillment. But we get through this short intro, and Ellison wants to know, what should we do on this silly show?
Hodel suggests that people should call in and pitch story ideas to Harlan, and he will collaborate with them on their story.
Which sounds like a fun exercise, you know, the kind of thing you might do in a science fiction writing class. I'm the benevolent teacher, give me some idea prompts, and I'll show you how to craft them into a story. Because, you know, a lot of people have concepts that they think are great. Oh, I got a great idea for a story. But few people actually pitch a full story, or at least an outline for a story, which has a beginning, middle, and end. However, it seems like Ellison has heard these kinds of pitches so many times, he's not going to be that supportive, benevolent teacher. No. He says, do I really have to deal with people who read science fiction? I saw a rerun of Todd Browning's Freaks last Wednesday, and that's about all the sci-fi fans I can handle for 1 week. And I know he's being funny, but at the same time, you know, there's a grain of truth in that.
Yeah.
He's definitely been around these people a lot. He says, if I had a dime for every clown who has ever come up to me at a cocktail party or a convention or at an autograph session and said, boy, have I got an idea for a story for you, I'd have just a lot of dimes. But he's up for doing it, because what else are they going to fill the time with?
And Harlan says, of course, if I sell the stories, I'll acknowledge the contribution of the caller. And Hodel says, well, what about the money from the sale? And he says, my philosophy is the same as Robin Hood's. Steal from everybody and keep it all myself.
Is that how that goes? I don't remember that.
They have their first caller, a woman named Joanne Gutraman. He gives the first and last names of these callers, I noticed. And that's something that you don't usually do on these call shows. It's like Bob from New York. So I'm like, why is that both names? So I thought maybe they might be famous or fledgling writers or people that he knew and he was name dropping them in the story. But I couldn't find anything out about Joanne here.
Well, some of the callers later are definitely writers. Some I thought were just randos. I didn't look this stuff up like you did, but you couldn't find anything on her, so we don't know.
No, no.
But probably that's somebody significant, maybe at the radio station or in one of the science fiction organizations in LA.
Joanne's idea is people are always writing about haunted houses. What about a haunted condominium?
Ooh.
Harlan berates her for her lack of an idea. But she's got a name for this thing. And that's what's really going to sell it. Mondo Condo.
That's a pretty good title. I like it. But this part did make me laugh because I have heard pitches like that, sort of Mad Lib versions of other stories.
Yeah.
And then the person thinks now it's original because they've replaced a setting or something like that, which happened a million times after Die Hard came out, right? Like every pitch or every, and a lot of these got made. It's Die Hard on a bus. It's Die Hard in a skating rink. It's Die Hard on a plane. Mm-hmm. Now it's a new thing. We even, you and I even did it once. We had to pitch some kind of Christmas movie, and we were like, how about Die Hard on a sleigh? Which we weren't serious about, but I remember the exec was like, Die Hard on a sleigh. I like that.
Doesn't even make any sense.
Doesn't, yeah. How does that play out? A sleigh
how
is a
big
very
is the
small
sleigh?
Vehicle.
Oh, boy. So Hodel whistles a little tune to give Harlan some time to formulate an idea, and then he goes into this idea.
Okay, how about this? Ellison said. How about this is a recently converted condo that was originally an apartment house built in the late 1920s. The custodian or janitor was a vicious creep who'd never do any work for the tenants. Everybody hated him. One of those kind of tormented devils Lovecraft was always writing about. And the only pleasure he got was from strangling cats. Maybe the building had a lot of old ladies on welfare living there, see? And all of them had cats, the way old ladies on welfare always do. And every week, some poor old lady's tabby would disappear. And what was happening was that this terrible janitor was snatching them, bashing their heads against walls, drowning them, strangling them, tossing them into the furnace.
And that's about as far as he gets with the setup.
Yeah, a Lovecraft name check in there.
Yeah.
Which tormented devils do you think he's referring to here?
I wasn't quite sure. That actually didn't sound like a typical Lovecraftian character. It sounds like more like a character from a slasher movie or something. I mean, there was the couple in the Cats of Ulthar who were murdering cats because they hated their voice in the night.
Sure, yeah.
Other than that, I'm not sure. Maybe Wilbur Whately would have been somebody that was a creep that people didn't like.
Maybe.
This janitor who hates cats, I didn't feel like that was a particularly Lovecraftian character. Anyway, he goes on to say, 20 years before, the janitor mysteriously disappeared. Not a trace was found of him, see? But now this expensive condo is being haunted by the sounds from the walls, a la Lovecraft. So I think he's making a reference to rats in the walls there.
Right.
Yeah. Ghastly sounds, hideous sounds, the sounds of the ghost of the janitor being torn to shreds over and over by the ghosts of these demon cats he buried in the walls and basement of the building.
So from that, the woman just is very quiet, and then she says, "You're a very disturbed person," and then she just hangs up. So Mike notes Harlan's dislike for cats.
This story actually in some ways is a little like the Chocolate Alphabet A to Z story.
It is.
Because we're just getting a series of little vignettes rather than one complete piece.
And I wonder as well if these are actually his ideas that he had at one point or another that he just kind of got rid of or didn't do anything with. Because I don't think this is based on an actual show where people really called it in and did these things. I think this is something that he put together on his own. I couldn't find out much about this particular story. I'm sure it's somewhere out there on the ether.
I actually was wondering the same thing, because otherwise I feel like in a story he can control it a little bit. Because if you did this on the air, I don't think you would have pitches that are even as good as the ones he makes fun of in here. You'd get some really random, "All right, I got this brother." But you got to hear the whole setup. You know, it takes 15 minutes. It's just about his brother and his garden. What's the point of this? I mean, that's what I feel like you'd be getting.
Yes.
But I wonder the same thing. Are these lame ideas that he had? Is he going through, via this radio show, his own creative process? Or are these things that he's heard out on the road when he's doing book signings and that type of thing? We never find out.
So the next caller is Mike Taylor. And I did a search on Mike Taylor and found a Mike Taylor who wrote for Deep Space Nine and Voyager. So it could be this guy. But this is about 10 years before those. So maybe he would be too young, but he was a slightly older guy. I don't know. His idea is an old woman with a sharpened spoon and hypnotic powers who steals the eyes from men and women for their vision.
It's a pretty solid concept. I get freaked out by eye stuff.
Oh, yeah, that's pretty.
You could build something around that.
Well, Harlan says, well, you know, actually, I already wrote a story that's pretty close to that called Seeing. It's about these people who have mutated eyes that can see special visions, the outline of a person's future, all sorts of things. I called them Forever Eyes. And the story is about a bootleg operation that steals people's Forever Eyes. So then Mike accuses Harlan of stealing his idea, despite the fact that it was written 6 years ago.
You know, that one I'm sure happened to Harlan a few times. Because people are so weird about their ideas and always think they're being stolen from, even if it logically makes zero sense. And I guess maybe the story is really all about blowing off steam, making some in-jokes, getting some of his derision out, whereas he might not do this in person to some poor sap who's just a sci-fi fan, you know.
I'd like to think so. The next story idea is by this guy called Buzz Dixon. Now, Buzz Dixon was a comic book and cartoon writer, and he wrote for G.I. Joe and Transformers, Teen Wolf, Dungeons & Dragons.
Oh, nice.
Sure, Harlan knew this guy.
And that's a really specific name. It's not, you know, Joe Schmo. Buzz Dixon, that's definitely a reference.
So his story, and I think there's some inside jokes for sci-fi nerds. His idea is, Blood World is a small, distant, barren planet enveloped in a dense, corrosive, poisonous atmosphere. It's named for the dark red blood that bubbles just below the planet's outer crust. The blood is pumped up and refined into Immortaline, a dark black liquid with almost miraculous healing and life-prolonging properties. Immortaline is very, very expensive and is much sought after. For this reason, Blood World's location is kept strictly secret.
Immortaline kind of sounds like unobtainium in the Avatar
it
movies.
Does.
Well, Dixon goes on to continue to flesh out this concept. Blood World, however, is sentient. It's a living planet with a form of logic vastly different from our own. Not different values, but an entirely different system of thinking and rationalizing. Blood World does share some concepts with humans, which makes communication theoretically possible. For example, to both humans and Blood World, love is the highest emotion. But to Blood World, to love is to kill. What can you turn that into?
So Harlan immediately ditches the "to love is to kill" thing. And he makes a story that is about humans stealing this goop, this Immortaline, from Blood World, and they bring it back to Earth, and then somehow that stuff wakes up Earth's consciousness. So all planets have this consciousness to them, but not all of them are awake. Blood World and Earth fall in love with each other, and they decide that they're going to kill all these awful humans that have been causing so many problems. But the tragic kicker is killing all the humans kills the only way that they had to communicate with each other.
Aww.
That's the sad end of the whole story. And Mike, actually, he likes that.
Yeah, I like it too. I kind of wish that that was the story we were covering in a way. Because now, yeah, that's a great ending. The two worlds are now separated by space and can't share this love that they've discovered. Plus, once again, Ellison makes humans the bad guys in general and kills them all off. So He really wanted to do that.
So the next caller is Joyce Musket. Joyce wrote an episode of the original Star Trek series, The Empath, which is a terrible episode. No. She is also one of those people that I think was a fan of the show, wrote a script, sent it in, and got it published.
Oh, I see.
In the story, Harlan seems to know her. She jokes that he's a cat lover, and he corrects her, and she's like, you know, I was joking. Obviously, you're not a cat lover, because you just talked about murdering a bunch of cats. But her story idea is about a cat that cries undrying tears. It's a tabby cat. Its name is Thalassa, the Greek personification of the sea.
Oh, that old story.
So Harlan's idea is this cat is thousands of years old, and if you drink its tears, you'll forget painful memories. The cat is captured by a person that wants to make a profit off the cat. The cat somehow tricks him into drinking one of his tears, and he forgets why he has the cat, and he lets it go. She says, I like that. See, you're not such an unfeeling prick after all.
One of the stories in the Chocolate Alphabet was like that. The Flensers, who take away your painful memories. And again, I was wondering if these are actual ideas he's gotten from people, or if he's beating himself up for his own bad concepts. Except this is one that he's kind of used before.
So the next caller is John Ratner. His idea is beautiful people in a Los Angeles where humans have grown fur coats on themselves and there's no fashion industry.
Weird.
These are kind of just rapid fires. There's no rebuts on these. Jeff Rubenstein says he's got an idea for a story about the domestication of Arabian camels to be used as race animals for American racetrack betting. National Football League players all want to ride them as jockeys. Ellison says, you're a good and decent human being because, oh, this guy, Jeff Rubenstein, runs a bookstore that that he goes to up in the San Fernando Valley. He goes, you're a good guy, but that is in the top 10th of the first percentile of lame-brained ideas I have ever had thrown at me.
I hope that Jeff Rubenstein wasn't serious about that idea.
Yes.
As much as it would be visually interesting. I don't understand why NFL players would want to ride them as jockeys when they have NFL careers.
I know, because it would be fun.
Because it would be fun, but if they're riding them as jockeys, that means they're competing. So are they going to split their time between football and riding camels at the track? I don't know.
The next one is this guy, Dan Turner. His idea for a story is in which someone invents a way for individuals to get what they deserve.
Now, that seems like a really uncreative idea, especially against that last one, which was so crazy. But that is one of the best I've heard so far in the story because of its simplicity. It's just a basic idea, you know. Mm-hmm. People are going to get what they deserve. It's almost a theme. So many sci-fi ideas sound more like that Blood World one, where there's lots of things you have to know before you even... What's the basic story here? You're just telling me about all these planets and the way people live and the, you know, their societal stuff. And Ellison responds to this one. He says, that's easy. The guy who develops the gizmo has been in love with this beautiful, witty, intelligent woman all his life, but she won't have anything to do with him. Contrary-wise, there's this plain-looking woman, not ugly, just sort of average, who's been in love with him, and she can't get him. Well, when he's busy turning this gizmo on people, giving them what they deserve, someone turns it on him. Hodel says, and he gets the plain woman, right? Wrong. He gets a thoroughly rotten woman. He didn't even deserve the nice, decent, average woman. I'm going to say the idea was better than the execution on that one. And Hodel agrees with me. He goes, that doesn't knock me out. And Ellison says, well, the original idea didn't send me to the moon either, Hodel. I'm dancing as fast as I can here.
So the next one is Charles Garcia. His topic for a story is another story is about the little blue Jewish aliens with wheels who needed a minion for their dying planet. And throw in something about the Pope, if possible. Now, this is in reference to a story that Harlan actually wrote called I'm Looking for Kadak.
I can't believe that he incorporated that kind of stuff into a story. A little blue Jewish alien with wheels, huh?
A minion is a Jewish quorum of 10 elders.
Oh, okay.
You have to be 13 years or older, and you get together and you have to decide something. So you'll call a minion if there's some big decision that needs to be made in the community. That's what that's about.
But also throw in the Pope.
Throw in the Pope.
Why not?
So he's pretty stumped on that one. The next caller is Meyer Allen Brenner, who is a fantasy novel writer who wrote the Dance of Gods series of books.
See, I didn't know to look all these people up. I'm glad you did. I honestly thought they were made-up names. I don't think I'm qualified for this in-joke business. I don't have the requisite skills.
I didn't know any of them. I had to look them up. They're pretty obscure as far as I can tell. Well, his story is a short natural history of the famous Chesapeake tree-climbing octopus.
Uh-oh.
This retiring and rarely glimpsed creature lives in the many quiet estuaries of the Chesapeake system. Early each morning, the octopus leaves the water, crawls up the trunk of a shoreside tree. It makes its way precariously onto a branch hanging over the water, where it waits for its prey to pass underneath.
Ellison thinks about this one a bit, clearly a little stumped. He's silent for a while.
Then, in a very soft, very tired voice, Ellison said, "These blue-skinned Jewish aliens with wheels come down to Earth and kidnap the Pope so they can have a race on Arabian camels to establish whether Jews or Gentiles are worthiest to live in the universe. And the Pope gets all these NFL players to ride as his team because they're all Polish or black and not a Jew in the lot. And they have this watercourse raceway and they race for the universe. And as they come under this tree in the Chesapeake system, the octopus drops out of a tree and eats every last one of them. Football players, Jewish aliens, the Pope, the camels, Brian Sipan, Terry Bradshaw, and Walter Payton, and you too, Mayor."
So he's just combined the last few ideas into a weird pastiche, and it seems like he's losing it a little bit because that's not really a plot. He's just being mean at this point, which I think is the point. That he's eroding a little bit as he goes through this process. And then there's a call from William Stout. It says the artist responsible for the best-selling Dinosaurs book. And William Stout says, "I want him to think up a story in which William Stout gets to meet some real dinosaurs." And Ellison knows this guy, seems very annoyed. So he says, "Okay, there's this story in which William Stout gets to meet some real dinosaurs, and they have lots and lots of real nice adventures. And if you want to find out how the story ends, go to the library and ask Miss Beckwith to let you check out the book. So long, Stout, you asshole." I'm kind of on his side there. That is a dumb idea. You're just talking about yourself. You didn't offer up anything.
No.
You're just promoting your book.
He's a really talented artist, by the way. I looked up his stuff. It's amazing.
Well, he's a jerk in this story.
I thought all this stuff was good fun, but it seems that Harlan is actually getting annoyed at this point with these people, and he's getting worked up into a tizzy. Like, his anger is part of his character and his grumpiness, but now it seems like he's actually genuinely mad.
He's really losing it at this point.
Mike says, "Yes, but you're the one making stories out of these crazy ideas." And Ellison replies, "I'm just a force for good in my time."
A guy called Tad Stones phones in and says, "How about this? An average-looking man offers the owner of a video arcade a free computer game for market testing. At the same moment, apparently, the same man is making the same offer to arcades across the country." Well, that's an okay one. Ellison says, "I aims to please Mr. Stones, an alien clone invasion from Far Centauri that has as its secret intent the violent overthrow of video arcades. How about it, Stones, you dip satisfactory?" This is funny because he actually just restated his idea. And a tiny little bit there, but why would it be for the overthrow of video arcades? It should be a much larger plot.
Of course.
Yeah, he did that on purpose.
Yeah, he's not making jokes at this point. His character is really fading. He's becoming noticeably just pissy.
Yeah, he didn't even try on that one.
Then a woman named Diana Adkins calls, and they both listen as she says, "This really happened. A little boy I knew, who was very bright, was asked why, in school and everywhere else, he didn't exhibit how bright he was. And he said, 'If I hold a candle under the bed, no one will see the flame.' When asked why he would hold a candle under the bed, he said, 'Because if I don't, someone will put it out.'" Mm. Hodel says, "That's very sad," but Ellison says nothing.
Yeah, he's doing a little trick here that kind of reminds me of On the Slab when we're about to meet the Destroyer to come in and and get Prometheus. And out of nowhere, he tells you this little sad story about the dying bird. Mm-hmm. You know, I was like, why doesn't Ellison respond? And I think he just was getting tired of all of these lame ideas and wanted to put in here a little tiny. Because that's a nice little micro story there.
I don't believe it.
That a kid said that?
Yeah, this lady says, "This really happened."
That, of course, it didn't really happen. That's something that like you would find on a wood plaque in a craft store or something like that. You know, but it is true. If you don't threaten anybody, then you won't get hurt.
Sure.
So if you don't exhibit how bright you are, then nobody will try and put you down.
This guy, James Harrelson, calls, and he's got a story about a televangelist whose sense of self moves from his head to under his right arm. And Harlan gets very pissy about it, just stops talking, and Mike has to say the concept is invalid.
I didn't even know what that idea was about. Hodel says, "Consciousness isn't in a certain location. It's wherever you perceive it to be. In the 18th century, they thought it was in the heart. The Greeks thought it was in the liver, which is why Prometheus had his liver chewed out by the big bird. Because of Freud, we think consciousness is in the brain." So great, but I didn't really know what the point of that thing was, other than we got another Prometheus reference.
Yes. So Harlan calls the guy a waterhead, and then the man replies by saying he didn't call to be insulted. And Harlan says, "Consider it Lanyap. Lagniappe, what the heck is that? Yeah. And it's a French word, French Louisiana word, which means a small gift a merchant gives to a customer. So he's saying, you know, you didn't come to be insulted, but that's a little extra thing I'm giving you as the insult.
Right.
Taking their last call of the night, since Harlan is out of juice and Hodel's is in luck because it's about something that he can talk about.
The caller says, "My name is Genadice Verlo, and my idea is that the reason Sherlock Holmes never went after Jack the Ripper is that the Ripper was actually Dr. Watson, and Holmes knew it." And yeah, that one made me mad because, oh, do we need another Sherlock Jack the Ripper story, please?
Yeah, Hodel says, "In point of fact, it couldn't have been Watson. The reason is, if you'll excuse the expression, elementary. Look, would you want Sherlock Holmes looking for you? Of course not. Watson couldn't be the Ripper. He'd know that Holmes could spot him right off. Besides, it's bad art. Too pat."
Yeah, and he's not even addressing the fact that she's saying, well, no, Holmes knows about it, but it's Watson, so he lets it go, which Holmes would never do. Never.
No, of course not. So Harlan is clearly ready to leave at this point. Mike says that they still have 33 minutes left to fill. Maybe they can just talk about whatever it is that he's writing. And Harlan looks at him with very cold and faraway eyes, and he nods in agreement. And just then, a voice comes in. It says, "May I impose, please, to enter your conversation?"
Now, they stopped accepting callers at this point. So it's that moment when the TV is still playing, but it's not plugged in, right?
No.
Oh, no. And I was glad, oh, good, finally something supernatural weird is happening. Because I thought the end of the story would be like, okay, signing off, you know. Yeah. Something has to happen in here.
So all the phone lines are dark and no one is connected in the booth, so they shouldn't be getting anything through. Mike can see this, but Harlan doesn't seem to notice. And the voice says,
"There is a concept of some interest. Postulate, if you will, an alien life form, an intelligent, sensitive being who, for reasons we need not go into now, has been cast adrift, marooned, if you will, in a dark place, alone, left to drift between the stars. And there it waits, without light, without weight, without emotional sustenance, without the companionship of thinking, feeling beings, a thing without purpose, waiting, forever waiting, drifting emptily in the stars."
So the producer is trying to figure out what the hell is going on, but Hodel keeps the man on the non-existent line talking. He goes, "Where are you calling from?" The voice says, "Nearby." Harlan jumps in. "But how do we know this being is as represented?" And this kind of sobers him up a bit. He seems to get interested at this point. Harlan does. "What if this creature, this sentience, this intelligence, was marooned by his own kind for reasons humans couldn't even understand, but for some quality or maleficence that branded it forever as a life form unfit to exist with?"
"With responsible beings?" the voice says, and then it responds with, "Then perhaps the lonely creature could wait until it could make contact to fall back on the kindness of other decent, responsible beings." Boy, did this creature call into the wrong radio show.
He says, "I see. Wait for some gullible young species that would be so amazed it wouldn't ask the proper questions, that it would take this Trojan horse in to succor it."
"To warm it."
"To nurture and protect it."
"Yes, yes, that is exactly what I speak of. A new home without darkness where the companionship of other thinking beings would return it to the community of intelligent beings."
"I don't think so," says Harlan. "What I mean is that we've known about you for a long time. You don't think they cast you out on their way past and left you there to find a home, do you? They left records. We know what you are and where you are. When we reach that pocket of space where you lie, we will do one of two things, ignore you or destroy you."
The voice slips and says, "You cannot destroy me."
"But it can be left to swim in blindness forever."
And then we get the ending.
After a while, Ellison rose. He let out a long breath and walked wearily toward the door of the studio. Hodel sat where he was. As Ellison opened the sound lock door, Hodel said, "Jesus, am I crazy, or did you just save the entire world?" Ellison looked back over his shoulder and managed a faint smile. "I'm just your basic, everyday force for good in our time," he said. "And if I ever offer to talk to fans again, I want you to drive a stake through my heart." He walked out. The door sighed shut, and Mike Hodel realized it was still 3 minutes till midnight. This is KPFK-FM, 90.7 megahertz on your dial. And this has been Hour 25. I'm Mike Hodel. Our crack engineer this evening has been Bert Handelsman. And for Terry Hodel, myself, and our guest, Harlan Ellison, this has been the hour that stretches. He paused for a moment and added, "And to all our listeners, wherever they may be, whatever they may be, I haven't the faintest idea what the hell went on here tonight."
And that's the end of the story.
Yeah.
I thought it was more that last caller was the personification of a bad idea.
Oh.
Because it's all about, what if I'm out here waiting and hoping that somebody's kind to me? And Ellison right away says, but you were cast out because you're bad. But what you're hoping for is that people will look past that and you'll get coddled. You know, he's essentially saying, we won't do that. And the voice is saying, well, you can't kill bad ideas. No, but we can ignore them so that they're just dead off in space. You know, I feel like it was something like that. The final struggle was between the very personification of all of these stupid ideas.
All right, that's good.
I have a note here that says, what was that last story about? So that only occurred to me just now as we were going through it. But I think that might be what that was. Whereas Mike Hodel goes, wow, was that a real alien? You know, they called in and he just saved us all. But no, I think it was Ellison making a final comment that we should just ignore these things.
The bad ideas of the world.
The bad ideas. There's no reason to say, well, you know, every idea is good. There's something good in every idea. I think at its core, Harlan Ellison does not believe that. There are talented writers and there are people who have good concepts and have an understanding of what's up. And then there's a lot of people who think they're writers who don't have the chops to execute.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be surprised if that was his point of view.
I didn't really care much for the story when we were reading it. But actually, after talking and reading it, you know, reading bits with you, I found myself enjoying it.
I got to say, I did not enjoy my first read of it at all. But I don't really like this kind of story because it's kind of shapeless. But yeah, you're right. I'm liking it a lot more now. And that was just a cool story I told.
Let's put that idea, Chad, about your impression of this story off into space.
It's a guy. No, I got a story. It's about a guy who read a story once and he didn't like it. And then later he read it again and talked about it and he liked it.
That's gold.
Ironic. It's a twist. Well, we will definitely circle back around to Harlan Ellison and probably dig into his more popular short stories at some point. I was sad that he died, but glad that we could finally have him on the show. And I want to thank Patton for recommending these stories for us. It was a fun way to round out the month.
Yeah. And I want to thank our reader, Levi Nunez, who is just fabulous reader and an amazing guy. Levi, thank you so much for all your work. And I just want to say next year is going to be the 20th anniversary of Bitter Green, the Wobble Shop album that you can find on Spotify. So if you want to check that out, I'm sure he'd be horrified that I'm mentioning it right now. But
he probably would. But I'm a fan of Levi's music. I've seen him play live.
He's a very talented guy and a good friend. So thank you, Levi.
That's super funny. You know who else I want to thank are some of our patrons.
Yes, me too. I would like to thank Sam Wood.
I'd like to thank David Kellogg.
I'd like to thank Jason Schomburg.
I'd like to thank Oliver Tsujoa.
I'd like to thank Simon Brilsby.
Dan Trikel, thank you so much.
I'd like to thank Thomas Johnston.
Philippe Norlid, thank you.
I'd like to thank Wolf Kaiser.
Last but not least, I'd like to thank Eduardo Garcia. You guys are all fantastic. Thanks so much for being part of the team. Next month, I believe we will be back with the novel The Invisible Man.
Hoo-ha! The Invisible Man!
Yes, we've done most of the classic monsters on the show. I don't know if you'd necessarily call him a monster. Yeah, he is.
Kind of.
He's one of the greats. Certainly, the Invisible Man film by James Whale is one of my favorites of all time.
Yeah, it's good. Good stuff.
I do love the book as well. And you haven't read it yet, right?
I'm reading it right now. I'm about in the fourth chapter, and it's great.
It's good stuff. And we're going to be covering that all month. I've been wanting to do that one for a long time. So please tune in for that. We've got more content coming your way, comments, shows, and bonus episodes. Tune in for all of it, folks. For now, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey.
And you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com and Patreon.
hppodcraft.com.